heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation.
The nation.
And now, Malcolm.
You know, it has never lost on me, as I suggest, I call it the big blue marvel, you know, in the universe of universes. And everything that had to go just right for our being to become who we are at this very moment. You know, you think about the simplest things we take for granted today. And will we become dependent upon all the things on a day-to-day basis that we count on? I mean, things like basic things, even like your turn the faucet on and your water runs out of the faucet, or that you have electricity and you're blessed that way. Of course, we didn't always have running water in the faucet and electricity, humankind, but this is the evolution now of all of it, isn't it? But, you know, when you think of all of these things, and then in the bigger picture, you know, as we get older, I think we tend to think more about life in this way, and we think about our own bodies. And, you know, I think about all the moving pieces and parts of our bodies, and we really are all walking miracles. I would suggest to you, that's the way I see it. We are all walking miracles. For everything to work perfectly like that, in sync and in step, to allow us to be able to do all the things we can do with our brains, and to be able to have everything just fit in, just that is what I would call a miracle. You're a miracle out there. You are a miracle. When's the last time somebody told you that, right? I'm a miracle. We are all miracles. This whole existence is some kind of a miracle. And then you begin to ask yourself, how did we get here? How did this all happen, the evolution of life? Of course, you know, everybody has a view and a position on that. Well, back in January 2011, it was Pope Benedict that said, the universe is not the result of chance, as some would want to make us believe. God's mind was behind complex scientific theories such as the Big Bang, and Christians should reject the idea that the universe came into being by accident. Now, that's an interesting way for religion to put it when that argument comes up about the Big Bang and God. That was kind of, I thought, an interesting way that Benedict puts it out there and says, well, listen, you can have both of those things. Yeah, you don't always hear it put that way, and I kind of like that, because you can have both of those things. You can have a Big Bang and you can still have God, because God created that. Okay, all right. Gets me thinking a little bit more. And it's unusual for the church to speak out about that, really, because they don't always speak out about that kind of thing, about the Big Bang, and discuss it in scientific terms at all, you know? Well, in 2012, a site that I often check out, space.com, our universe could have popped into existence, they say, 13.7 billion years ago without any divine help whatsoever, is what they are suggesting. And they say, in space.com, the Big Bang could have occurred as a result of just the laws of physics being there. And this was Alex Flipenko out of the University of California, Berkeley. Within the laws of physics, you can get universes. All right, well, I accept that. I think you can. But then for everything else to go the way, for all of these other intricacies to happen and for the perfection of life to develop and for us to be the creatures we are, I don't know. I don't know that you can convince me of that all happens by accident. It's just coincidental, really, is the better word. Coincidentally, everything happened by coincidence, you know. So it's important to look at all this to understand the big world, I think, and step back from this and say, okay, so it depends on which road you want to take, people, you know. Did the Big Bang versus God, or God and the Big Bang? I mean, you've got multiple choices there, but that's where we find ourselves now. And I think to take it further now, what also is interesting is where are we going with this? One of the problems in humankind is that far too many people live in the past and they don't know how to move it forward. They stay in the past. And then there are those people who live totally in the future. They don't live in the present, you see. And then you've seen the wrath of people that want to destroy our history. They're bent on destroying everything that made us who we are. That would be like, you know, destroying every museum that ever existed or every aspect of life. Of course, I do believe that the way you, well, the way you can help not just predict the future, but create a better future, live, because it's important we live in today's world, in today's minute. But I always use that example of 90-10. You know, use the rearview mirror 10% of the time, but use the front window 90% of the time. And that's something I've always lived by, actually. So I don't live in the past. I don't have regrets. I don't know if you have regrets out there, but I don't live in the world of regrets. I should have done that. Yeah, there are things we could change. We would all change if we could change. It's a whole litany of things I could read off to you and change. Do you have a crying towel? You know, we can cry together, you know, things we would have done differently. Sure. I mean, we don't get a chance to do a redo. You know, once we go through as a young lad, we go through school and all of that stuff. We make the decisions of relationships and how our life is going to be and our career path. Well, once we make those choices, they're kind of made. Now, that doesn't mean we can't change things along the way. And it doesn't mean, and I also like the fact that some people, you know, they say, well, you're never too old. And I see people in their 80s and 90s doing incredible things that people, you know, that you would think they'd be in their 50s to be able to do the kinds of things they're doing. It is kind of the new 80 today, actually, when you think about it. I mean, we're living much longer than we ever have. Although, I mean, in current modern times, that is. I mean, we're not going to go all the way back to Genesis and into the Bible. Although it would be fascinating if we could live 800-900 years, wouldn't it? Now, you know, we don't get that anymore. That option is not a choice in the evolution of who we are as a species anymore, for sure. But I do think there's a lot to this, and I think if we're going to have the best quality life we can have, I think what's happening, my fellow Americans, is we get caught too much in the moment. We get caught too much in the news cycle. We get caught too much with all of these negative components of our lives all around us that just not only stifle us, but they create this fear in our brains. And it's really like we all are tense and because we don't know what's going to happen next. And of course, there's so much going on in the world and there's so much going on in life right now that I think sometimes the decisions we're making, we're not looking at the big picture. We're not stepping back to look at the big picture of life. And we don't count our blessings either enough. And I say that to you all the time. We don't count our blessings enough, not as much as we should. You know, to think this whole miracle of life that we enjoy, that we are, that we exist. So I do think it's an important step in our existence to step back, look at all of this, understand the history. We should not be destroying our history. That is the path forward. That is how we create a better path forward and a better life. And that should be clear to everybody. And you don't go around destroying the negative things you didn't like that happened 50, 100 years ago. That's called history. It's part of life. And you can't change those things either. You can only change the way what you're going to do next. If we don't remember some of those things before, how are we going to know? And how are future generations going to know? They're not. And that's kind of silly, people. Yet it is, it's a real argument. It's a debate we're having now on campuses and in boardrooms across America as far as, you know, all of this history and what's real, what's right. It's like they want to eliminate parts of history they didn't like. They want to destroy it. They just don't want any part of it. But they don't understand that's what makes us so great. That's what makes us who we are today. It gives us really a better playing field today. You see, I'm looking at it that way for a moment. Look at it that way. But I think a lot of the people that are doing that too don't really have the best outlook on life, quite honestly. A lot of the people that want to do that are carrying around a burden of problems in their life. They're living far back in the past, and they don't know how to move the ball forward, and their only idea is to create all this chaos and craziness in their lives, really, I think. So let's do this. I want to do this today. I want to really peel back a little bit and take a look with you. A very interesting gentleman, Professor Larry Bell, will be joining us today. And he's got a thinker. Professor Bell is a thinker. So he looks at things, which I love about that. And you know me, I love when we step back from a problem or a situation and we can look at it just slightly a little bit differently. In fact, that's where innovation comes from. That is innovation. In order to innovate and inspire, you've got to break things down. You can't be afraid to do that to be able to innovate and inspire certainly a generation of people. Professor Bell has a new book out, How Everything Happened, Including Us, which we'll talk about today as well. And let's have a great conversation with Professor Bell, and we'll do that just after the pause on The Voice of a Nation.
Listen to Malcolm, the Voice of a Nation, on iHeartRadio or our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep, but it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Our global experts are brilliant writers and engaging hosts on a mission of a lifetime. You'll find the latest news and inspiration on the front page of AmericaOutLoud.com.
So one of the things that Professor Larry Bell talks about in his new book, How Everything Happened, Including Us, and he says this, and I want to start here. Well, the story begins a very long time ago, 13.7 billion years ago, about 5.3 billion before our planet was born, 4.5 billion years ago. It then took another 4 billion years for Earth to become teeming with simple, single-cell organisms, which eventually evolved into you and me. This involved a very long process as well. And Professor Bell, Larry, I'd like to start right there. And I find that interesting because I am fascinated with us as people. I always think about our bodies and our lives and how we became. When you talk about our single-celled organisms and what we are a miracle, are we? I mean, do you look at it the same way? Or
yeah, Malcolm, and I appreciate you having me on and really enjoyed your introduction. I thought it was very, very thoughtful and very much on target in terms of my own views of things. And with regards to the religious connotations and philosophical connotations, this is something that perhaps humankind will never sort out to everyone's satisfaction. But even when you look at the hows it happened and chronicling the major events that occurred and how we're awash in this marvelous thing called history, it is truly a story that is much larger than any narrator.
Yeah. Larry, I don't think we ever will determine that. I think what you just said was totally accurate. I don't think we'll ever really conclusively know in this lifetime what exactly is happening. But I do find us that we lose sight. Too many people take life for granted, and we take everything for granted, and we don't see ourselves as miracles. I mean, think about it this way, Larry. If we walked around and we recognized the fact that we were walking miracles, that this whole experiment is a miracle, maybe we'd have a better way to look at life. What do you think?
Well, I wrote in another book called Cosmic Musings.
Okay.
It begins by saying, consider the odds that any one of us would never have been born.
That's right.
Consider that your mother and your father had to meet out of, you know, billions of people on this planet. Your mother had to not have a headache on a particular evening. And then playing back, their parents had to meet. And we are, you know, we are a country that is certainly diverse in terms of people from all different parts of the world. And mm-hmm. part of my ancestry is American, Native American Indian. It's also European. I think if we look at these, any one of our histories, we feel really blessed and fortunate that we are, you know, such a mix of histories and such a mix of individual histories and national histories. And if things had happened in any different way, none of us would be here. And so it's like we won, and then you have one sperm cell out of millions that happened to advantageously beat out the competition to fertilize an ova. And you know, the incalculable odds against any one of us living, and to not appreciate how important life is and the opportunity for life is when we won the greatest lottery of all. And we're born winners, where society today is telling people they're born losers. And I find it a terrible irony in this whole story. Absolutely, what you're saying is that if we look at our own history, if we look at the history of our world, and in the five mass extinctions that have existed, that basically gave us the opportunity to become alive, and the, you know, the whole, you know, the time frame from the first cell, which happened billions of years after the birth began, to walking on the moon. I've known a half a dozen of the people personally that walked on the moon in my lifetime, and some of them kissed my children goodnight at night and stayed in our home and so on. And you think of how we're part of history. As you mentioned, we're also creators of history, individually, collectively, through our gene pool, through our activities, through the way we vote. We tend to lose ourselves in the sense of minutia and not realize that, you know, our terribly important significance, each one of us. And it's kind of like Brownian movement, where one molecule hits another one and sends it off on other trajectories. Each one of us is bouncing against other molecules and setting off trajectories that we'll never know, we'll never understand. A teacher never knows the influence they'll have on their students. Parents never know what influence they'll have over their children, their grandchildren, and so on. And we are part of this marvelous system. We're integral parts of it. And I think you made that very clear in your introduction.
Boy, I love the way you put it back out there, Larry. I have to tell you, you speak so well about this big picture. When you just got me thinking, I was grinning from ear to ear as you were talking, because, and I'm sure listeners were as well, because when you think about, there's no random chance. I mean, all of the things that would happen again with your mother and father meeting, and the mother and father before them, with all the billions of people on the planet, for everything to be just right. It's a marvel that we are all at this moment, and too many of us don't look at this as a blessing in life. I think this gives me such inspiration, this talk today, to recognize this. Now, I want to ask you something here that is going to require you to think outside of the lines, or some people say the proverbial box in their life. But I want to ask you, Larry, something here. When we look right now at our moment in time, right now where we are in the year 2020, so much has happened. We're in the midst of historical changes, clearly, that are taking place right now. The history books are being written every day in the path forward. And when we look at everything now, and have we been living in one of the most exciting eras or times in human history right now with all of this happening? Or was that moment just prior, like, you know, 50 years ago when a lot of the advent of technology was happening and before computers came to play and all of that? Or is it just ahead? I mean, if you had to pick these three eras, Larry, of time, what does it say to you? I mean, is it 50 years ahead? Is it right now? What is this the moment, or did it happen already? And I'm talking, I mean, it's all exciting, human history and humankind is all, but what do you think's happening right now?
We're caught up in all these changes that are occurring, and where are we in this? And when you look at, and I'm maybe in a way peripherally answering your question. On one level, I want to say that, you know, I think we're all guilty of what I call a temporal narcissism, where we do, as you mentioned in the introduction, we live in the moment. We're so caught up in the events that seem to be all important. They've never happened before. We think that they're singularly dangerous or exciting or transformative or whatever.
You bring up a great point there. They never happened to us before. You're right. With all these things happening, we think, oh my God, like, this is it. Like, this has never happened. Well, sure, it never happened to you before, but it's darn well happened in history probably somewhere, Larry. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying it, yeah, in different ways. For example, we think of ourselves as being so sophisticated and, you know, we're so intellectual, but I think the, you know, experience of the Democratic Convention should have diffused a lot of that in our minds. You know, we're really looking for style points rather than, you know, than substance. But as we look at, you know, one of my interests, and I have many, is looking at the, you know, history of particularly the Civil War and so on, and reading the letters home of these individuals that fought in the Civil War on both sides, and they were supposedly not very learned, but they were learned. They were learned in the real world, and they were so eloquent. You know, without, you know, they used language. They understated things. They endured things that are just unimaginable to us today. And we realize, I think, in looking at the past, that we haven't gotten a whole lot smarter in a lot of ways. And in many ways, I think maybe we've lost contact with a lot of realities. We're so specialized now that we tend to not live holistic lives as perhaps in the past, but temporal narcissism, where we think, well, you know, we are awash in events and this has never happened before. And oh my gosh, we're shut down and we can't go out and have our latte at Starbucks and so on. And I don't mean to minimize this. It is a big impact and people are dying and so on. It's a tragic thing. But I think in the longer span of history, if we look at ourselves, the one thing that writing the book brought home to me was how rapidly things are accelerating. And they were accelerating for different reasons. You know, maybe at one point it was the opposable thumb that, you know, got us out of the trees and we became hunters and gatherers and then farmers and those people who domesticated cattle and then those who learned how to sharpen a stone on both sides to make it sharper and went from the Stone Age to the, you know, to the Iron Age, to the SUV and so on. How compressed time has become, how inordinately, unbelievably fast, where it took billions of years to get the first cell going and moving around and being able to replicate itself. Yeah. To the point now where we're looking at quantum theory that has absolutely changed physics, where Newtonian physics that works at one scale doesn't work at the subatomic scale, and our whole logic system breaks down. And we say, well, it doesn't make any sense. Well, of course it doesn't make any sense, but it works. We can build quantum computers now that can outthink us in many respects. So it's if you look at the acceleration of events and how, you know, they're just moving at warp speed right now, and it's confusing, it's overwhelming, it's something we say, well, it's larger than we are. It's faster than we are. We can't possibly contemplate this. And I think there's a sense of tuning out this, again, this temporal narcissism that says, wait, hold on. We, you know, things are moving too fast. Technology is moving too fast. We can't understand it. So we might as well just submit to it. And I think we're at that point today. The question is, will we ever master it? And where is it leading us, as you mentioned in your introduction?
Well, ironically, we do get impatient and we do want it yesterday. We are a society like that. Now, we want it now. It's everything's instant today, Larry. We want it instant. You know, we want it now in an instant. You bring up a very good point that a lot of this stuff has taken certainly billions and millions and thousands and hundreds or whatever chapter of years to get to somewhere. And here we are. And if you look back at the last 100 years and the evolution of mankind, I mean, we are moving at warp speed now, aren't we now? Just in a short period of time, we've done so much. Mankind has, that it should give everybody thoughts. You know, I always think on that basis, Larry, like, what are we going to be 100 years from now? In fact, a lot of the craziness out there and the decisions that political leaders and others in powerful positions are making, and it makes me step back and think, you know, with the kinds of things they're doing, and often cases it's for greedy purposes or self-serving motivations. And I think ahead, what do we really look like 50 years from now? Because we're not only moving at warp speed, Larry, but I would suggest to you we're moving in some dangerous territories. And I'm not talking about the computer problem yet or the AI world. I'm talking about just man itself being man's own worst enemy. And instead of challenging and fighting the big problems that could potentially end our world, we fight with each other on this small little amazing blue marble that floats in the universe of universes. And so I think about it in those terms, and I think people get lost. You're right. In that moment of narcissism, as you say it, this, like, everything is that most important thing in your life right this very moment. And so I wonder, what do we look like 50 years from now? And that was the way I was trying to ask you a bit of, what do we look like 100 years? Do you have confidence? Do you feel like we're on the right path or the right trajectory as a people? And certainly I would ask you that question, Larry, as a nation. How do you feel in your heart as a man who has lived a lot of life and understand this? What do you think?
Well, your question splits my mind in different directions. And one train of thought is that in the past, we've thought of development as being somewhat linear in the sense that we progressed from agricultural, from the Industrial Revolution to the Agricultural Revolution, which was made possible by industry and so on. And we look at how the Industrial Revolution was somewhat linear. One development led to another to a supply chain change and different paradigms and so on. We're in a different mode now with the information revolution, where it's no longer linear. The algorithms, we have algorithms now designing algorithms. And if you take the stock market, for example, we use computers initially to say, well, how do we measure a company's performance based upon its history, its leadership, et cetera, to make good bets. Then we have algorithms now that play the market and say, well, they can make bets and make investments, and they can beat out other algorithms. And so you have algorithms competing with algorithms in the world where that's totally changed. But another aspect of this is that, unlike a linear development like the Industrial Revolution, which we think was rapid, but it occurred rather slowly, and it was related to such things as developing new energy systems and electricity and DC current and AC current and Tesla and all these other things. It was a relatively very slow evolution compared to in information technology, because each field, each area is can be looked at as something it's an area that's creating its own algorithms. And so it's something that is growing exponentially in almost an infinite number of dimensions. And so, and then you take this to still another level where you say, well, let's look at, you know, the notion of cataclysm, or look at the cyber warfare. I wrote a book on this. Is that there was fairly recently we thought of mutually assured destruction, where only a couple of countries, and then later another more added, that could really annihilate another country using say nuclear weapons, because nuclear weapons are complicated, sophisticated, expensive, and so on. When it came to then the cyber warfare, we found that why would we do an EMP attack? Why would somebody launch a dirty atomic weapon into our atmosphere to knock on our grid when you can do it with a virus? And as we did with the Israelis in shutting down the Iranian system for a short time. So now you can our adversaries and terrorists can buy these bugs off the dark web. And so the more sophisticated you are, the more connected you are in terms of the internet, and we're all connected to the internet now. You know, we in America live in the glassiest house in a low cost stone fight. You know, where you can shut down the grid in North Korea, but so what? They shut down ours. It's quite a different matter altogether. And now we add to this the biological, warfare, and we, you know, did the Wuhan virus come out of a laboratory or out of a fish market? Well, you know, you can hold your own opinions about this, but it makes you realize we can engineer now viruses that have absolutely, you know, we don't have to be reminded, devastating effects. So we can look at all of this and we can say it's doom and gloom, and we can say it's the end of the world. We can say, you know, we have security cameras now on every lamppost. It's truly Orwellian now in terms of the issue of privacy versus security. And we keep trading off more and more of our privacy, more and more of our individual choices. We say, well, it's in your interest. You need to wear the mask. You need to do this. You need to do that. And it's no longer by the electorate. It's by appointed officials that are making these decisions. And so it's easy then to become despondent and say, well, woe is us. You know, it's the end of the world is coming. But we can also take the contrary view that we're opening up possibilities that we can never imagine before, you know, in terms of innovation and creating new possibilities and being able to communicate globally and to be able to have algorithms that can translate languages for us and be able to access information in every library in the world to enhance our intelligence and our awareness of things. So what is the answer? Is it we're going to destroy ourselves for sure, because we can't control our technology and we can't control our hunger for control itself? Or are we viewing a new world of unlimited possibilities that are truly going to transform humanity into something more than sound bites and style points, where we really begin to embrace, you know, physical systems and become interested in science again? And I think the answer is both. Mm-hmm. The answer is both. We live in a terribly terrifying time. We live in a very exciting time. In the book, I make a very conscious point of not being judgmental about history. History is what it is. You mentioned this in your introduction. History is what it is. We can't change it. I thought Harari's book was good, you know, and so on. But the moralizing about history and the sapiens knocking off the Neanderthals, who are just good hunter-gatherers and so on, and shame on us and so on. This kind of Malthusian view of the world, that we're just, humans are bad and, you know, be better off without us. I'm going to stay away from the moralizing. I'm going to stay away from, and I attempt to do this in the book, where history is much bigger than my narrative. I simply try to chronicle what it is that happened and certain sequences of events. And one of the real challenges is to say, well, what are the big events and the small events? Because inevitably, the small events drive the big events. Yeah. And to not also attempt to look at it from a Western society point of view, but look at what are, you know, globally, what are the things that happened in terms of, you know, species and changes and so on, and impacts on climate and so on. And so you introduced this very well. I mean, we live in a miracle, and we're, you know, we're part of history. We're creating history, and future generations, perhaps moralistic or non-moralistic, will look at us and say, we were change agents, whether we wanted to be or not.
Yeah.
What kind of changes did we bring about? What was our artistry and what was our inequity in terms of being able to deal with the challenges that we face that are perhaps no more challenging than those that were faced by generations long before us?
Yeah, well, Larry, I suggest picking up on where you're at, that the risk is greater is what's happening now. And you talked about nuclear proliferation, and you talked about a EMP or something of that nature, or just cyber threats that are now so everyday apparent. There are a myriad of cyber threats that hit our grid every day in every aspect of our lives. So what's happening to me is, sure, you know, the conveniences and the successes, but the risk gets greater and greater and greater, possibly because we live in the biggest glass house, as you just suggested. That's a perfect way to put it, Larry. And that means that I think what I see, Larry, is we got to get it right. We have to get it all right. Now, the problem, what bothers me, or what really gets me a little edgy, is this constant fight on of good and evil. There's a lot of evil out there, you know, I think sometimes in the case of, you know, how much evil is there as compared to good? You know, I see myself as one of the disciples of good. My job and my role here on this planet is to foster that good and to be a voice of reason and put a message out there that resonates with people, but gets them to action, to do something about it. Because it's one thing to sit and complain all day about everything. It's another thing to provide some solutions and some ideas to move the ball forward. So when we look at the point we're at now historically, like you say, we are being change agents, Larry, whether we like it or not. You're exactly right. And you know, it's upon us. And we are going to have to answer back to generations ahead. Did we get it right? Did we do it right? Did we understand the risk? And can we move this thing forward? So when I think we look at it all like that, to me, I think nobody should lose sight of the ultimate fight of good versus evil. Because, Larry, that is central to this conversation I have here on the Voice of a Nation, on the show we're on right now, but also at America Out Loud. Good and evil is again, the biggest fight in all of this. And it's why it's so imperative that we have these conversations. And it's why we want people to think a little bit more about all of these things. The book is brand new. It's a brand new book, and I love listening to Professor Larry Bell talk. I have to tell you, I'm a big fan of his and his work. And he's a prolific author. He writes about so many unique things. But his this book here we're talking about today, How Everything Happened, Including Us. It's a great title, How Everything Happened, Including Us. Now, that book is in the America Out Loud bookstore, as you're hearing this. Now, it's brand new. It's a new book, just come out this a month here, and so you'll get it right in the America Out Loud. That link is on the nav bar right at AmericaOutLoud.com. You'll see it on the left there. Just click there, go and type in Bell or Larry or How Everything Happened, Including Us. The book will come right up, or you the front page changes randomly, the books that are listed on the front page. So if you don't see it right there, just put that in there and it'll come right up. I think what it will help is put your own life in perspective, which is what I love to do for me, is to put my life in perspective and ask myself questions like, you know, what am I supposed to be doing here? What's my role in all this? Am I on the march to doing what I'm supposed to be doing here? Am I being a good steward for the planet? What can I do better? That to me are some of the ultimate questions I ask myself all the time. And how do we impact people's lives? There is no greater reward in this life, my fellow Americans, than to impact another human being's life. That is the gift of life that I see. And it's a beautiful thing. And I love to bring it to you here. So you will pause a moment there. Stay right there. We'll have Professor Larry Bell back with us in just a moment. Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
The silent majority has spoken. We say, let the silent voices be heard. You can be the voice of change. Contact our producer at liberty@americaoutloud.com. liberty@americaoutloud.com.
All right, we are talking with Professor Larry Bell on The Voice of a Nation, and it is a pleasure to have him on with us. He's just a great thinker. It's wonderful to have voices like Larry's who think outside of the lines of life a little bit. He's a fantastic author. Again, his new book you'll find in the bookstores we just talked about there. And so in the book, Larry, you say here, what about the likelihood of the existence of other intelligent life? So first, let's assume that by intelligent life, we're referring to creatures we might be able to engage in meaningful communications, if not actually enjoy socializing with, particularly if they do not pose a threat to self-esteem and well-being. So let's go through a few things here now. When we talk about intelligent life, it's an interesting place to start when we talk about alien life or life in universe. I'll touch real briefly with you on UFOs. There's been a lot of talk. There's always been a talk about UFOs. I've never been a big follower of the story, quite in full disclosure with you. Although I am a big supporter of our NASA and supporter of our scientific community and exploring new worlds and all of that around. I mean, I am absolutely a big proponent of all of that. But recently, in past months, in these past recent years, Larry, there's been multiple videos from Navy pilots encountering these mysterious fast-moving objects. There was quite a series of these in 2018. The New York Times reported just a bit ago here. It gets into all kinds of things. They were captured by Navy FA-18 Super Hornet jets, and the pilots realized that there was something else going on here. Now, people try to explain that or not. When you look at the Pentagon has just created a new program, the Department of the Navy, under the Secretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security, will lead this new program, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force. Do they exist here? I mean, UFOs are just an unidentified flying object, but I mean, taking it further, are there other life forms trying to visit us here that we're not aware of?
You know, when you ask these questions, it always triggers in my mind, three other questions. And
I know.
So going back to your original premise and Stephen Hawking's point of view and so on, we live in a galaxy with thousands of, you know, billions of stars, and each, many of them have planets, and a certain number of them would likely have conditions that could nurture some form of life and so on. And then there's thousands of galaxies, billions of galaxies in the universe, in our known universe. And of course, we don't really know the universe very well. But the notion that life only exists, you know, whatever we call life, exists only on this planet, I think is rather ridiculous. I think probably the universe is teeming with life, although most star systems don't have it, but you know, according to Drake's equation, there's, you know, probably thousands of millions of planetary systems that are capable of supporting life. then we kind of segue forward and advance forward and say, well, yeah, but what about being visited by some of these forces, or
right,
or maybe we even go so far as to say, well, what is really intelligence? We talk about intelligent life, and you know, if a computer can you know, supercomputer can beat humans at most mental processes, then are they, you know, are they intelligent? Will we ever create intelligent machines? And by that we say, you know, really intelligence, we refer to that as natural intelligence. And I say, well, what's natural intelligence? What makes something natural? I say, well, because it has empathy, it knows good and bad, and it has these, you know, has, you know, it loves Mozart or, you know, rap music or whatever it is that makes it, you know, we can humanize it, kind of like Disney figures, you know, the mouse is dressed up like a human and we can relate to the mouse as being worth thinking about. So there's this sense of, you say, well, no, computers can't really do that because we have to tell computers what to look for. We define the problem for a computer, the computer can solve it for us, but it takes a human to identify the issue and identify the problem. Well, maybe not. With machine learning, computers are learning how to observe analogs and look at similarities and differences that we don't see. They can do oncological scans of cancer cells better than humans can. You know, a lot of things better than we can. So what is natural intelligence and so on? What is, are we, you know, is, and which kind of brings to the point of what is it to be human? Mm-hmm. You know, why are humans better than machines? And then you bring up the notion of good and evil and these other issues that sort of kind of raise those questions. Say, well, what about UFOs?
Right.
Which, as you say, by definition, we don't know what they are. They're unidentified. And you say, well, to travel from one star system, the Andromeda, you know, galaxy to ours, whatever, it takes so terribly long that, you know, many light years that you know, that it seems rather unlikely. Whether or not the Earth is even interesting enough to attract aliens is another question. I was one of the first Americans invited to visit the Russian space program after the Berlin Wall collapsed and after the, you know, growth of the Soviet, you know, this post-Soviet space program. And I was one of the very first Americans invited over to meet with the top-level people in Russia that had launched Sputnik and Gagarin and so on. And one evening I was entertained by a professor at the Moscow Aviation Institute at his home. And in his home, he had a photograph of the Boron shuttle, which was really a knockoff of American space shuttle. And it was over his hearth, you know, and it was on the wall. And he showed me the picture, and there's this little spot above the Boron, above the launch vehicle. And I made a quip. I made kind of a joke. I said, it looks like a flying saucer. It looks like a UFO. And he said, let me show you an exploded view of that picture. And he showed me this picture and this enlargement, which is clearly something that was not a balloon, not an accidental thing. It was very geometric. To the life of me, I can't remember if it was spherical or whether it was, you know, exactly what the shape, whether it was more of a cylindrical shape. But I racked my brain. I can't remember. But it was clearly something that looked metallic and looked, you know, and he said, we've observed these and we have an interest in this. And I thought, well, this professor was a very well-known professor in Russia. He had no reason to try to impress me. He had no reason to have this picture on his wall. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't have a clue what's causing this. I have astronaut friends. I've asked about this and their opinions are as diverse as anyone else's.
Well, as they say, things are not always what they appear, are they?
They're not. And and so it's something,
yeah.
And of course, people are always suspect of saying, well, it sounds like something that would, you know, create a lot of media interest or whatever.
Well, a lot of reports I've read about these unidentified flying objects is that, you know, typically there's somebody on the other side given a reasonable explanation as to what that might be. So, in other words, I constantly see there is somebody always shooting the idea down. Now, you bring up interesting when you look at, again, some organism on some planetary system somewhere. The chances of that happening are probably more so than not that life is out there somewhere. But as you say, whether we're even interested enough in them to travel to us is fascinating. And I like the way you pose that question as well, Larry, when you say, well, what makes a human human and what makes us more important than a machine itself? Who said that exactly? Well, because we have what, feelings, they say, and we have a brain and we're different in some capacity. In other words, it's only all this is the way it is because it's in our minds that way, Larry, right? I mean, we've said it's that way, so it is that way. Isn't that just like, you know, anything in life? I mean, just like why certain words are dirty words, rather words being clean words. Who said that was a dirty word, Larry? I mean, was there some god of dirty words who said don't use that word? Because you know what I'm saying? So we kind of put it all out there and say this is the way it is. We kind of make our rules up, don't? Aren't we making our own rules up?
Well, we are, and I think of the movie 2001 Space Odyssey, where you have this computer named Hal, you know, and Hal.
Oh yeah.
Hal had a human ego, apparently, because
Hal overheard
the other astronauts saying that, yeah, you know, Hal screwed up, he misguided us, and so Hal, you know, Hal was able to read their lips because, you know, pretty smart computer. He's designed at the University of Illinois. Yeah. I used to be on the faculty at University of Illinois. I never knew Hal very well, but in any case, pretty smart computer. So, So Hal devises this scheme. He realizes the computers, the astronauts are going to shut him down, and so one of the astronauts out there on what we call EVA, extravehicular activity, out there in a spacesuit, and Hal locks the hatch on him, you know, and he's gonna kill the crew and so on, and great thing. Well, of course, human spirit prevailed, and they blasted the hatch open and saved the crew, and so on.
We all remember that. We remember that moment. So that brings us to the big ultimate point, which you talk about in the book, by the way, which is the whole aspect where you finally get to an artificial intelligence race versus the human race and the quantum leap forward. And you talk about, this is interesting in place to what you're talking about with Hal, Larry, and that is, the computational power of the human brain is largely pre-wired by evolution. The AI capacities arising from revolutionary computer technology power applications, right, are growing exponentially. So, right?
You're totally right about that. And
so we are, and we don't really know. And when you say in the book, well, will computers control us? I mean, that's a discussion that, you know, well, computers are only as good as what? Is what we put into the computer? Is that the idea, Larry? Or will computers control us? I mean, do you have the answer to that question?
I don't have the answer. I think it's an answer that requires a lot of ethical interpretation. But it's not only will the computers control us, but will the people that control the computers control us? And I think we see this now with Silicon Valley, and we see this with cancel culture we're seeing, and so on. And the ability to control information is, I think, enormously important and critical. So on one hand, it's a question that those that can control the computers and the information. The other aspect of this is the notion that the computers control us and they outsmart their masters. And this is becoming less and less of a joke and more of a concern as we see algorithms taking over more and more of our intellectual processes, and we become kind of the tenders of technology rather than the leaders of technology. And so these are interesting times. They're challenging times. They're daunting times. We can read into them, you know, the worst of all possible worlds. We can read into them that these transformational changes will cause us to now maybe reflect on what it really means to be human, so we can develop and practice humanity in a way that perhaps we have neglected in the past.
Wow. Incredibly well said. Professor Larry Bell, you're listening to there, and I want to encourage you to go get his book, How Everything Happened, Including Us. It is in the America Out Loud bookstore, right off the nav bar. You can get the link for the bookstore, my friends. But it's on Amazon. You can get it anywhere, basically, that you can buy a book. And, you know, the thing about Professor Bell is he makes you think. I love when he says at the end there, I have to tell you, those who control the computers control us. That should tell you everything for all of you out there that are so fearful for the, again, Silicon Valley, as he says, and a lot of the tech companies and all of that. And what we're seeing with, again, that big word, algorithms, it's like a 25-syllable word, people, you know, algorithms. You know, the algorithms are only as good as the people who tweak those algorithms and tell them to go look for what they're doing. So it's the language we tell them to put in there, even though when they're up there talking to the politicians, they, of course, deny, lie, and steal, and cheat, and say, no, no, it's the algorithms, it's not us. We're onto that argument and debate as well. But it is true when he says those who control the computers control us. He's so precisely right to look at it that way, which should tell everybody what's really important. The takeaway for me there is we need to do our darndest and make sure that the body of good people are the ones that are in the mode of control in those computers. I think so when he asked the question even in his book, like, okay, so will computers control us? Which, like he just said, I don't really have the answer for that, which is why he poses that question in the book, by the way. Okay, but, you know, the answer to that book is, the answer to that question is that I would say, probably yes, if we're not really concerned and, you know, meticulous about who's controlling these computers. Because, you know, it's that whole saying, people, garbage in, garbage out, right? You've heard that before. Garbage in, garbage out. Brilliance in, brilliance out. I mean, what you put into it is what you're going to get. It's like everything else in life. What you put into it is what you're going to get out of it. I mean, come on. And that's certainly what it is in the algorithm world and certainly the computer world. I find it a really unique moment in time, incredibly unique. You know, I said to you last year, we were coming through a historical moment here. I told you when we launched The Voice of a Nation, there's this program well over a year ago that we would be in the fight of good versus evil. That was the whole mantra in the evolution of this show. We would take on the fight of good versus evil, and we would represent good here. That would be our role. I told you that in the first couple of episodes. And here we are, and we take it on every day. And so, again, our show, again, 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, and the encore is at 10 p.m. That's Eastern time, 6 and 10. You hear it anywhere in the world, on iHeartRadio, our world-class media player, or our apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. Be sure to join us on Viewpoint this Sunday, which is our world-class news magazine on Sunday, 10 a.m. Eastern time. And then Viewpoint Presents with myself, Malcolm, and Michael Johns at 11 a.m. Eastern time. 2 hours of talk radio excellence every Sunday. It's the leading news magazine and the fastest growing in the nation. Thank you, my fellow Americans, for being with me on the journey here and the mission of life, always trying to uncover the next chapter. It's time to get involved and get loud.